Hello, welcome to the Unseen and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. As usual, we bring you exclusive insight and stories from David and our team of writers. Coming up today, David is back, so we discuss some of the lines from his column, including concerns over Mason Greenwood and how the January transfer window is shaping up. Plus, we will hear David's interview with the former Watford and Leicester boss, Nigel Pearson. We'll also be joined by our German writer, Raphael Honigstein, who's been speaking to players about their experiences of playing for both Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp. To read all the articles we discuss on today's podcast in full, head to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to sign up for just £1 a week. David's YouTube show, Ask Ornstein, is back this week as well. Subscribers can submit questions in the comments section of David's weekly column on The Athletic. And I'm also back on this podcast feed on Thursday alongside Matt Slater for the second episode of our brand new pod, Business of Sport. So David is back, as we said. How was your break?
It was good, thank you. I feel refreshed. Thanks for having me back, Mark. I feel Laurie held the fort extremely well on the column and podcast. And I feel privileged to be back in your capable hands.
Well, you say held the fort. I mean, there were times when it felt like a blatant power grab. I mean, I don't want to tell tales out of school, but...
Is this like Project Big Picture?
Absolutely. He's looking, as I said to him, he's looking for 14 other votes from Athletic writers, and then you're gone.
Well, judging by today's Monday column, he's got the lead item. He's got another item in there, so I'm not sure. I don't know what club I'd sort of compare myself to. If he's the Liverpool, am I, a Crystal Palace or...?
Well, I don't think he'd want to be the Liverpool. And also, comparing yourself to a club, I think you're only going to open yourself up to a load of abuse. But when I did open the app, the Athletic app this morning, to read your column and see that the first story came from Laurie, it did amuse me a lot. So what is the story anyhow?
So it's a very interesting story, and I guess we've got to be very sensitive about it. Mason Greenwood's only recently turned 19 years old, and he's had a lot of publicity. His rise to prominence has been fairly spectacular, and it doesn't always go completely smoothly. In fact, it rarely does for many players of that age. He's, of course, of a generation that we can't relate to amazingly well. And we've got to understand all of that. He's at one of the biggest clubs in world football. He's got unbelievable talent. People at United and England are convinced he can become a world-class player. But we know the incident that happened alongside Phil Foden in Iceland. There have been some concerns, it's fair to say, about his kind of lifestyle and commitment, especially his adherence to the COVID protocols and rules that are very strict at Manchester United, like they are at all clubs at the moment. And, you know, this is actually, as you say, an item by Laurie, so I'd suggest people go and have a read of it, because there's quite a lot of detail in there about, you know, worries he's not getting enough sleep, and that could be affecting his immune system. Bit of lethargy in training ahead of the Everton game, which he wasn't picked for, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said that that was related to illness. So there's a lot to take in here. It's my understanding that, you know, Gareth Southgate has conversations with all Premier League managers ahead of naming his squads. He spoke to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was particularly enthusiastic about the idea of Greenwood being called up or recalled. I don't think he necessarily gave a glowing endorsement of recent things that have been happening for Greenwood. And it was mutually agreed by the two of them that he would stay with United, and hopefully things can move in the right direction. A lot of pressure on a very young man. Phil Foden has come back into the international setup, and it was sort of explained to me that not so much remorse, contrition, more the reaction to the Iceland incident has perhaps been a little bit more impressive from Foden. The penny sort of dropped perhaps a bit quicker, more profoundly with him. And so, you know, I think everybody wishes the best for Mason Greenwood and hopes that in time maturity and experience and development will lead him to flourish on and off the pitch in the years ahead.
Every individual is responsible for themselves. So I'll preface that before putting this next point out there. But if you actually look at the discussion that's around Manchester United at the moment, about leadership and where the leaders are within the team or within the squad and so on and so forth, then, you know, maybe Phil Foden has been helped by City having perhaps more experience, more leaders in their team or their squad than United do at theirs. City are arguably a more stable club from where they, you know, from the success they've had in recent years, whereas Manchester United are not. And again, I reiterate how I began this. Every individual is still responsible for themselves, but you don't know what the support is around someone who, as you've pointed out, David, to an older fart like me, is still a teenage kid.
Yeah, and I guess this is a little bit subjective because you heard Harry Maguire recently arguing that United have a lot of leaders on the pitch. Certainly that was one of the reasons why Edinson Cavani was recruited, for his experience and being able to relay some of that. And I think, judging by what Laurie's written, Greenwood has been encouraged to, you know, seek advice from the more experienced heads at United. Currently, I think it's clear that City are further along in their journey. They've won a lot more. They've experienced a lot more as a group. What I do think is that there's a better setup around the team at Manchester City. I've spoken on this podcast and we've talked and written a lot about director of football and structures at Manchester United, and I do think it's more advanced at City. Pep Guardiola, Cheeky Beguiristain, Ferran Soriano and everybody around City, it's really, you know, sort of industry leading. And I think United have got some work to do in that area. They are working hard. They do have lots of very good people, and hopefully for them it will come in time. You rightly point out that it in a huge part comes down to the individual as well. So Greenwood and those around him will need to take some responsibility. There's a lot of talk within the game of agents trying to bring Mason Greenwood into their fold, but at the moment it's kind of controlled by the family. And there's a lot of talk about new contracts. As Laurie writes, that's kind of been put to one side for a moment. It's not long ago that he did sign a long contract.
He signed till 2024. So as Laurie points out in the piece, United are fairly relaxed about being able to eventually get all of this ironed out.
Exactly. And I don't think now the time is right for that. But it was something that was immediately being looked into as he started to gain more first team appearances, goals, England call-ups. It's not unusual that you might look to renegotiate quite soon. It happened in the case of Brandon Williams, who I think signed a new contract just recently, and that was a very short time after his previous contract. So there will be a desire to get things moving in the right direction again, and then I'm sure look to maybe improve his terms. Or, I mean, he's, as you say, he's probably on a very good contract that rewards incrementally his progress and development and achievements, etc. But we could get into a wider debate here about, talked a lot about over the years about, you know, the academy setup and players having a lot too soon, having a lot to take in. One person described this situation as perhaps being a little bit different, actually. It's not so much about too much too soon. It's more about the generation, this fast tech generation that these young players are growing up in, the people surrounding them, and also, you know, the psychology of it all. Mason Greenwood and Phil Foden achieved the biggest accolade in terms of international football at such a young age by being called up into the national team for the first time. They went away to Iceland. They had full briefings like all players do. Their responsibilities would have been made abundantly clear to them. There were the COVID restrictions, which make this time more delicate than ever before, really. And still they sort of indulged in behaviour that people in the England setup just cannot get their heads around what possessed them to do that. Now, everybody makes mistakes and of course they'll learn from it. But there is many dynamics to this about young players coming through and at such high profile in the social media era. And it is concerning, but hopefully it will lead to improvement.
And also, just that final thing, because you mentioned the COVID situation, and I don't care whether you're a footballer for Manchester United or a kid in, well, America, for example. Let's take America, because we have a global audience. Mm. You know, if you are a teenager, and as a parent of two teenagers, if you are a teenager at the moment, this is seriously hard for them. I know it's hard for lots of people, and people deal with it in different ways, but a lot of teenagers are finding it very hard, and that is a unique situation at the moment.
Definitely, and Greenwood will be no different to many of those people you talk about from a human level. You know, he is just in a very different environment to many of the people he would have grown up around, who I'm sure are still around him socially, influences and people he's friends with, but very few of them were working or, you know, growing up at one of the biggest clubs and institutions in world sport, in football. And the COVID protocols and restrictions and expectations will be down to an absolute T, from testing to what you can and can't do, the bubbles you can interact with. Extremely difficult, but these are sacrifices that need to be made, and it's not easy at all. Something will need to change, improve, and hopefully that can be done sort of organically. And it feels a bit hypocritical saying this because we're talking about him, but without necessarily the glare of the world watching every single move he makes.
I thought there was a very interesting line in your column today about how players who are currently at clubs and hoping for loan deals in January might actually find it easier to get a move to a club than a free agent.
Yeah, this one's a little bit subjective as well. It depends who you speak to. And I'm only reflecting conversations that I've had. It seems that January will be a very quiet window from a permanent transfer perspective, but a really busy one from a loan perspective. And that's because many clubs, and I reference the likes of Manchester United, Chelsea and Arsenal, for example, didn't manage to shift as many bodies as they would have liked in the summer window. They need to get those players playing for the players' careers, for their valuations, and if they hope to sell them. Clubs don't want to buy players that haven't been playing. So loans will tend to dominate. And with this really rapid turnaround from windows, it's unprecedentedly short, the gap, because obviously the window's just closed and it's about to open again. In theory, those players that have been in-house, in the building, so to speak, have been training with first teams and should be in pretty good condition. They will have been in an elite environment, subject to all the testing and levels of training that all the other first team players have. Even if they haven't been playing in competitive fixtures, they should be closer to match fitness than somebody who's a free agent and has been training alone. You know, high profile cases like Jack Wilshere, Daniel Sturridge, I think Mario Mandzukic, if we go further afield, Mario Balotelli, Ahmed Musa, and so on. Those players, as has been quite well documented, training in parks or alone or they can find environments that are elite or close to elite, but it's not inside a club. And the way it was explained to me is that when clubs are looking to take players in January, they want them to have an immediate or an impact as quickly as possible. And they're going to favour players who are in-house in the building. And so you might favour a Danny Drinkwater, for example, to a Jack Wilshere, just because he might be a bit closer to match football readiness. And therefore, it's all the more important that the players that are free agents now, unattached to clubs, they get moves before that window opens and before they enter a really congested market. You've got to weigh up the opposition. Who are you competing against now to get into a club? Who are you competing against in January? Well, now you don't have any competitions really. So, you know, that's why the likes of Wilshere are weighing up their options. He's had several offers. I don't think anything really concrete. He turned down an opportunity in Australia. I think he would probably prefer to stay in Europe. He's talked about seeking a new challenge, maybe even the MLS, which could be an exception to what I've just explained, because you could go there in, say, January, and you've still got 2 months, depending on when the MLS season starts. There's reports it could be April, and he could do the full preseason there before starting the new campaign. Sturridge might be a bit different as well, because many clubs are on the lookout for a striker, and he's a striker and available. So it is an interesting dynamic, and just the way it was explained to me by a few people, despite the fact that free agents are technically easier to do deals with because you don't have to negotiate with a club, they might accept a lower salary. In the case of Wilshere, he's been paid 85% of his contract already by West Ham. So he may only be looking for a deal worth, I don't know, 15%. And then he can say to himself, well, I've broken even here. I've leveled out. I can take a really low salary at a club and get playing again. But it's easier said than done, because many of these clubs will be wary of players that have been out of a club environment, that haven't been in competition. They'll be looking at their injury records. In the case of Sturridge, he hasn't played since, I think, the 22nd of February. And then in March, his contract with Trabzonspor was terminated by mutual consent. Wilshere was much more recent, mutually agreed to leave West Ham. So it's a really interesting time for loans and free agents. And January, and even the weeks before, should be fascinating.
And the other thing that comes out from this piece is for clubs who've sent players on loan, because of the short space between transfer windows, you're not really going to get players back, are you, such as Moise Keane?
Yeah, so there will be some deals that were struck in the summer that have recall options. I don't know if that's the case with Moise Keane, but what I do know is that Everton sent him to PSG for a reason. Dominic Calvert-Lewin is their first choice striker. He's done fantastically so far this season. Yep, they've sort of stuttered a bit of late, Everton, in their last four games, and that's coincided with him doing really well. I think he scored four or five goals for PSG. But that's precisely what Everton wanted. They wanted him to go out and get game time, to get exposure, whether that means to come back to them, because there's no option to buy, as we understand it, or whether they're going to sell him. It depends how things work out at the end of that loan deal. But yeah, they want him to stay there. And I saw a lot of Everton fans on social media saying, let's recall him as soon as possible. As I said, I don't know if that's possible. And also, Everton's intention is for him to stay, play, and to shine. And you'll see that with a lot of players, because it's been a matter of weeks since those summer transfers were finalised in many cases. I don't think, it would take a drastic situation for a club to recall somebody so soon.
And one other story that we must mention, Jose Mourinho's unhappiness that Wales Wales have an Arsenal coach looking after his players, including Gareth Bale. A case of do as I say, not as I do?
Well, quite, yeah. Typical Jose, really, when he pointed that out. Albert Stuyvenberg, I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, is coaching with Wales, obviously. He's stepping up somewhat in the absence of Ryan Giggs. He'll be working with Gareth Bale. All of that came out last week, and it raised some eyebrows at Arsenal, because they're aware that, you know, Chris Powell, who works with the Tottenham youngsters, is part of the England setup. Arsenal have some players in the England setup. Steve Holland is described as a friend of Jose Mourinho. Of course, he coached under him at Chelsea. And ironically, when in 2016, Steve Holland, I think, did he share the England role with his role at Chelsea? Maurizio Pochettino, the Tottenham manager at the time, protested that's not right. He's obviously now in the England setup, and Jose's close to him. So a bit of North London sparring there. I think it's all very lighthearted, to be honest.
Ralf Hoenigstein will join us in a little while on the pod. But next up, we're going to play a Nigel Pearson interview with David, although he hasn't actually recorded it yet. So he's going to do that shortly, and then we'll drop it in. I actually spoke to him over the weekend, and I thought, rather than bore him with my questions again, it's all yours this time. He's a lovely, lovely man, and he's a fascinating interviewee.
Yeah, the perils of pre-recorded audio is that we were meant to do the interview with him before the pod. We could have discussed it. We're now doing it after, and I have no idea what he's going to say. And that's kind of the beauty. I'll look back on this with a bit of a chuckle, but I can't wait to speak to him, because we've not really heard from him. He's done some interviews in the last few days. That's the first time he's spoken since leaving Watford. He's a really interesting professional and person. Many people feel he's a complicated, slightly unknown quantity. He's very diverse in his interests away from the pitch. You know, he went through a really difficult period that he's just revealed his health situation, as he describes it, long COVID that he didn't kind of realise he had when he was at Watford towards the end, and around the time of football shutdown, and the effects it's had on him physically. It's really taken its toll on him. He seems to now be in better shape. He seems very scarred by the way his time at Watford ended, not so much his sacking, but more the way Watford went about it, their lack of communication and explanation. I think there's so much to get into him with, from his personality to his experiences, notably at Leicester, more recently at Watford, being in the heart of talks around Project Restart and the manager and players conference calls, Black Lives Matters, everything that was going on at that period in time. A really difficult situation at Watford. They were doing pretty well under his leadership. They seemed to be heading for safety. Rug was taken from beneath his feet, and we'll never know if he would have taken them up. Hopefully, by the time you listen to him speaking, he will have got into at least some of that.
Right, what one question have you got lined up that you're going to ask him that you're worried about? Because then when you ask it, we already know that you're a bit nervous about asking it.
Maybe his reflections with hindsight on calling the journalist Ian Baker an ostrich.
Right then, let's see if David actually asked this question during the Nigel Pearson interview. Here it is.
Well, Nigel, thank you so much for your time. You've actually done quite a lot of interviews over the last few days, which is somewhat out of character for you because you hadn't spoken since leaving Watford. And you've always been quite selective with your time in management because you've always focused very much on your job. How have you actually found speaking so publicly, and especially with journalists who you've not always had the smoothest relationship with, let's say?
Smoothest relationship. I'm normally, I think, quite approachable, and I suppose when we're not crossing swords or at least dueling with each other from time to time, I think there's always a recognition that I'm trying to do my job and they're trying to do theirs. One of the things that really is a bit of an irritant for me is lazy questions. And I've probably got myself into a few fixes over the years. I think for the most part, the relationship that I have with people in the media is pretty good, really. I can't get away from the fact that I've had a few incidents which are a bit notorious in that sense, or it's infamous rather than, you know, it's one of those situations that from time to time have occurred. But look, I mean, of late, I felt it was important really just to, and I suppose it's quite cathartic as well to actually talk about your own experiences, especially when, for me, I've suffered with illness as well as, I think that it was only right to try and get my perspective over. I didn't want to do anything until I felt okay and felt well enough to do it. I'm not going to be overly visible from now on. It's not a case of overly exposing myself, and it's just that there were a few issues that I wanted to sort of get out in the open.
You talk there about notorious or infamous incidents. Do you ever think back to the so-called ostrich gate when you had a sort of tete-a-tete with a journalist at a Leicester press conference, and Ian Baker, and you called him an ostrich?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in many ways to reflect on that sort of time. I know it was under a lot of pressure, and there's an element of that, but I think it's not very likely that would happen again.
You sound a lot more phlegmatic. So much has happened. But when you do reflect and look back, as you've just said, do you like the person you look back on, or is that too simplistic?
I've recently said that I probably don't dislike the parts in me that I dislike quite as much. I don't know whether that's something to do with being a bit more experienced, being a bit older. I don't know, but I'm fairly comfortable in my own skin. I am what I am in many ways, and I don't try and justify things that have happened in the past, because you know, it's not all bad things that have happened in the past. I've done some things I'm very proud about as well. So it's all a part of life's rich tapestries, to use a corny sort of phrase. It's amazing, I suppose, what pressure does to you. And, you know, if you're somebody like me who's very protective of the people that I work with and for, I think there's an element of that as well that maybe I at times have tried to take too much of the pressure myself. And I suppose one of the downsides to that is that you can, that maybe you absorb too much. There's got to be a point where you cannot absorb anymore. And I suppose that's, but your awareness of that when you're in high pressure situations, I suppose, are not always accurate, or you're not always aware of of the reality of the situation when you're experiencing it.
The illness that you experienced, could you explain how bad it was, to the extent that in one of the interviews, it sounded like your family were gravely concerned? And I don't mean to be morbid, but was there any thought about life and death at that point? Was it so severe?
It got to a point where I really did have to do something about it. I was at home and I could not, you know, my wife was having to move me. I'm a bit of a lump, so that's not easy for her. I couldn't even turn over in bed. I mean, I was literally immovable, and I had days where I literally couldn't move. There were some days that I probably was asleep. I was behaving like a cat, I think. 95% of the day I was asleep, you know. So it was not great. The consultant that I saw, she was very, very concerned that in the state that I was in, if I, on top of that, maybe got the normal flu, yeah, my life would be in danger. It's a very sobering thought. I'm still far from being my old self, but I'm certainly a lot better than I was 2-3 months ago, for sure.
Just to briefly fill in a gap for anybody listening, Nigel thinks that he experienced COVID in March while he was Watford manager, and then has actually been through what's being described as long COVID with numerous other symptoms related to that. When you were experiencing it, sort of March, April time, you came back with Project Restart, you left Watford, and then it got particularly bad around August time. Do you think when this was happening at Watford, I mean, we saw the Mikel Arteta diagnosis was publicised more recently, David Moyes, various others too, that for clarity, when you weren't able to attend press conferences, as we now know, and friendlies ahead of Project Restart and certain training sessions, that it might have been worth making this public just so people know? Or is that just being simplistic with hindsight?
The thing that I'm always very concerned about with doing that is people who would possibly say, looking to make an excuse. It was a consequence of systematically going through the employees of the club having blood tests. And yeah, that's when I found out I got it, but I had the blood test because I was experiencing joint pain and I wasn't feeling quite right. It was something I couldn't put my finger on, but it wasn't necessarily something that was causing a problem. But I had a couple of allergic reactions, which were not particularly pleasant. And there were some days that I literally couldn't move. I'm on the road to recovery, but there's, you know, I'm going to have one or two setbacks from time to time, I'm sure. But you know, I'm a lot more positive now than I was.
You were involved in the manager conference calls. There were players conference calls going on at the same time, wage cut negotiations, the Black Lives Matter issue at that time. You talked in the Athletic interview with Stu James about, in some of these meetings, a lack of empathy within English football that you found at the time. Can you take us inside those calls?
Managers with different personalities who are representing clubs that have, you know, different perspectives. And then you've got the Premier League who are driving the course, if you like. What I never felt was that there was any great clarity. There was definitely, for me, a lack of sincerity. I would have much rather the sales pitch be, look, I know it's not in everybody's interest, but we really do need to get this going because the industry is in dire straits. And rather than try and sell this picture of it being safe, 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 and we don't know whether it's safe, safe, safe now, I would have preferred an honest forum rather than a stage-managed, condescending, patronising flavour, which I actually felt that we got. So, you know, consequently, you get managers, coaches who would just spend a lot of time listening, which is fine, because you get an opportunity to say what you think and you either take it or you don't.
Have you seen and experienced a lot of things over the last year or so that make you think, you know, I'm not sure I want to be part of this sport anymore?
When I'm out of it and I come back in, I realise how much I miss it.
Yeah.
The driving forces are still the challenges, the enjoyment, the building of relationships, the fun that you have. It's almost that draw of being involved in not always a struggle, but a challenge with other people. My private side of my life, I'm not going to suggest I'm a loner, but I do like my own company, and I wouldn't necessarily go out and seek to be with lots of people. So I do really enjoy being involved in a team situation as a part of a team. You know, it's something that I think is a big stimulus to me, and it's something that I enjoy. I would miss terribly if I didn't have that sort of a involvement. So you've got to remember, I've really worked now in professional football since I was 18. So that's like 39 years. There are still massive ups and downs, which I think are a part of the draw. I think it's my love of the struggle of it in my own world dealing with it that is actually a big draw for me. Maybe the fact that I've, in the last few years in particular, dipped in and out of it is probably given me a bit more, you know, I wouldn't necessarily choose for that to be the case, but sometimes, you know, when you become a manager instead of maybe being an assistant, there are fewer opportunities, and also how other people perceive you in where they would think that you might be available or not available. Again, it can sometimes limit, and certainly how people would view my personality might limit it even more. You never know. I don't know.
It must be quite some draw and stimulus, in your words, to take you back for more, even despite the quite sort of bruising and angry end that at Watford and the way they went about it. You've talked about it in the interviews. It hurt you, a sort of perceived lack of class. What was it like working inside that Watford regime? Is that bad for your health? Because from the outside, it looks fairly chaotic, this hiring and firing of managers.
I, for the most part, really enjoy it. I didn't have a lot of, you know, since I've left, people expect there to be, they make the presumptions that there's conflicts and there's argument. You know, there was nothing. I can't give you any answers because I've got no idea, apart from anecdotal stories that I've heard that, you know, he just wanted to change and see whether the players would react. Well, if that's what it is, that's what it is. I can't do anything about it. So I'm not going to lose any sleep over it now. But, you know, I'm talking about at the time, yeah, I was furious and I was annoyed, of course. But because it was an opportunity for me to get back into the Premier League that I didn't think would be available to me again. So I was very grateful for the opportunity. Hey, it's what it is.
I guess in fairness to the media, those sort of questions and that curiosity is fueled by incidents like which happened at the end for you, which seemed quite extraordinary that you were denied entry to the training ground and players and staff found out about
clean for the deep clean,
supposed deep clean. Yeah, that's where that impression comes from, don't you think?
It's
possibly remarkable, that situation.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, you know, I'm a bit of a wily old dog as well, in the fact that I made sure I rang the doctor to make sure, you know, is there a deep clean? No, there isn't. Craig and I tried to arrange our practice match then. I said, okay, then we'll go down to the stadium to train. We couldn't train there because there was work being done to the pitch, so I just got in contact with the ground staff and no, there wasn't any work being done. But they were told that if I got in contact to tell them that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't use it. You don't have to be an absolute genius to work out that there's something possibly going on. Me being probably seeking a little bit of confrontation made sure I got to the training ground early so that they had to turn me away. So, you know, it's you use your sort of, I don't know, your nous to try and work things out. So it wasn't a shock when it happened in the end, although, you know, the timing of it wasn't probably what I expected. But, you know, the stories that came about, the, you know, the half-time at West Ham, Yeah, I wasn't at all happy.
A post-match row with Gino Pozzo?
I didn't see him. No. He was at the training ground watching it. He was at the training ground with the sporting director. There was no argument to have. The last time I saw the owner and Scott Duxbury was in the car park the next day. So, and there was nothing said then either.
And it was especially surprising from the outside because you had posted a couple of wins and got the team into good contention to survive before the sort of rug was pulled from beneath your feet. One interesting part was when you came back, and we now know for Project Restart, there was a lot of politics. There was also your ill health. There were positive tests at Watford. Troy Deeney, obviously a talismanic figure, wasn't coming back to training for his own concerns. There was a lockdown breach with players attending a party. Was that chaotic, that period? Because then what followed was a run of defeats. Was that particular time before you picked up with a couple of victories a bit of a mess? There were so many different issues.
It's not about excuses. It's about this. These were the circumstances that we worked in, and however other clubs worked, and I it doesn't matter how they worked, because we worked with the scenario that we had, and a number of our players have got big concerns, and I don't blame them,
Yeah.
You know, but did it have an effect? Well, I think, you know, if you look at all the, and it continues now, actually, the number of strange results that, you know, since restart, even through the start of this, that there have been results that you wouldn't understand, or you wouldn't certainly, you wouldn't predict necessarily. So who knows how the changing climate with the fans not being there. I mean, I think that was difficult for us, because playing at home for us was a massive dimension to us, and I think there's a lot of football clubs would feel the same. It's very difficult to predict what the how the circumstances affected everybody, but look, we all had to deal with it. And I would still say that, okay, so the seven games after restart, we got 7 points. So it's a point per game. And over the course of a season, you know, that was only marginally below what we'd been averaging before. It wasn't what we wanted, don't get me wrong. You know, we expected to do better than that. It was just a situation which it felt different. People talk about momentum. You had to deal with a situation that was not necessarily what we expected it to be.
One specific player I wanted to ask you about, Ismaïla Sarr. He's had a lot of interest in him in the transfer window that's just gone, specifically from Liverpool. How special is he? And also, would clubs come to you and ask for your advice on him? Have they? And what would you say?
Firstly, no, I've not been asked about him specifically in terms of clubs wanting my opinion on him as a player. My own opinion is, you know, a young man who's very, very talented. There was a part of me that was surprised that he didn't go in the window. But I think if Watford can, and they've also been quite canny with Jerry De La Feuze and Maxi Pereira, both at Udinese. So, you know, so that there's an opportunity, I think, that if they get promoted this year, that they'll still have retain the services of their best players. And I think, you know, you would look at that as say, well, that's good business, really, if that can be the case. And I think for Sarr, for instance, it would be, the Championship might be a really good experience for him, you know, because I think at times there was an awful lot of expectation on the lad's shoulders. I think if they're still doing really well by the January window, you know, they'll probably keep him again. And he's a very talented boy, but I think it's very, I'm always loath to build the expectation too much on players like that, because they're going to have moments. And he's had some injury issues as well. So I think he's another year acclimatizing in the English game, maybe with not the level of pressure on him, might be very, very beneficial for him. But he's certainly a very talented boy.
Since you've been away, is there anything in particular you've really, really enjoyed doing? Have you actually prepared for a return to management, or have you immersed yourself more in music, in TV and film, in, I don't know, religion and politics those sort of interests outside, because we've heard and read a lot about the nature that you enjoy. What about anything else?
I feel as though, because I've not been as well as I would like to be, that I feel as though I've wasted some time, which is probably be a bit unfair on myself, because when I've had a chat with a doctor this morning, in terms of a progress report. I think I've got to be careful I don't put too bigger expectations on myself. I'm not going to go from one place to another in one leap. I've been very frustrated, as so many people are, I'm sure, but one of the things that's really struck me this year is the fact that I've not been able to travel. And I think that's quite a, we take for granted to a large extent how much freedom we do have in terms of our ability to move around. And I would have loved to have just jumped in my camper van and gone to Europe and spent a bit of time just, driving around or whatever. And so I've not been able to do that. I think a lot of people will be feeling this as well. This, the very fact that we are told that we can't travel is in itself quite a difficult thing to sort of deal with, I suppose, in some ways. I just feel that I would have loved to have done more. I would have loved to have spent more time outside doing, the activities that I like doing outside a bit more. Even when I've been at home, I like to read, but I've not read enough. And it's one of those where I can't explain it. I like to do things and I've just not been able to find the inspiration to do things. And I think there's a bit of frustration in terms of, a lot of it's been to do with how I've been feeling myself, with my health as much as anything. So it makes me more determined to get back to where I was, and whatever the next challenge is, work-wise, that'll be, I'll make sure I'm ready for that. But I think what I've promised myself is to make sure I don't waste time in the future. I've realised that time is precious, yeah.
It really is. And you've given us more than enough of your own time today. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And it's fascinating to talk to you because, as you said at the top, we might not get too many more chances after this little period. And we wish you only well with your career and, most importantly, your health and your future.
Thanks, David. Really appreciate it. And thank you. So that's a chapters for me, yeah?
Will, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, after City and Liverpool drew yesterday, both managers aired their frustrations with the scheduling and also their desire to see a return to five substitutions. We've heard something similar from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer recently. Dean Smith, after the Arsenal game, maybe not surprisingly, feels it should stay as it is. It's obviously the so-called top six, the big clubs, whatever you want to call it, David, who are pushing this more. Do you see anything changing?
Well, I don't know whether pressure from the likes of Solskjaer, Klopp, Guardiola, Arteta, and it seemed that there was some kind of conference between Klopp and Guardiola at full time about this very subject. Whether that's going to get them anywhere when there's this, other perspective that Dean Smith articulated and he'd be joined in that by several others lower down the division. I don't know if it's just going to be some continual stalemate if they've got to vote it through like some of these other things we've been talking about in recent weeks. It is a bit odd that the Premier League are alone in this. You speak to people who just see it as a no-brainer and forget your competitive balance in terms of who it favours. Just think about the players and their well-being and the rate of injuries we're seeing. Especially soft tissue is alarming. I tend to sort of sit on that side of the fence. It feels to me to be something sensible. I see strength in depth at many of the lower clubs, and many of them are getting good results against the so-called bigger clubs. So I don't know which way it's going to go, but if it's a vote inside the Premier League, then there could well be a standoff that leads to no change.
Well, Klopp called out Richard Masters and the Premier League, citing the fact five subs are happening elsewhere in games in Europe, including, of course, the Bundesliga. Let's talk to our German football writer, Rafa Honigstein. Was it straightforward for the Bundesliga to keep the use of five subs?
Yeah, we never heard about a breakdown of the voting, but remember, in the Bundesliga, it's 36 clubs, Bundesliga 1 and 2, who make these decisions. And I think that puts a very different complexity on this matter. I don't think there was ever an issue that, you know, some middle-ranked teams in Bundesliga 1 or 2 thought that maybe they would get a competitive advantage if they restrict the bigger sides to only three substitutions and kind of game the system that way. I think there was just universal agreement that the season was going to be so congested, so crazy, that they had to do everything possible to protect their players. If there was any dissent, it's not something we heard of, which makes me think that it was a pretty universal view.
Is scheduling an issue in Germany as well? I mean, that's the other thing that Klopp and Solskjaer in particular this weekend have been critical of.
Not really. I mean, we don't have lunchtime kickoffs, which I think are extremely unpopular with managers, particularly if they have to come back late from an international game. That's something that we've heard over the years and doesn't really change. If anything, it just makes it more difficult right now. There's also, of course, far less demand because there's no League Cup. There are fewer matches with only 18 teams in the league. And on top of that, the Bundesliga have always tried to accommodate teams. So rather than force, you know, a team that has a difficult away game in the Europa League or in the Champions League, more relevantly, into an early game, they will always make sure that teams in the Champions League will not play on Sunday, even though they could, you know, theoretically play on Wednesday and it wouldn't make much of a difference. But no, it's always a Saturday. And if possible, they will also, at least one of them, give them a Friday game, so they have an extra game as well. So they basically feel that it's worth protecting these teams rather than having that leveling effect that you get from more games and this kind of scheduling. I think for the Premier League, it works as a spectacle because I think it like the Christmas period, this is kind of one extended Christmas period this season.
Yes,
it makes things a lot more unpredictable. The league, I think, or the most of the clubs see it more as a, in the view of how can they protect their players rather than, you know, maybe eke out an edge.
And the other clubs just happily accept the accommodating the needs of the clubs involved in European competition.
It doesn't really affect them. I mean, of course, you could say, you know, if you're Dortmund, oh, Bayern play on a Friday and we play on a Saturday and that helps them now for the Champions League. But of course, the next week will be the other way around. So unless they play each other and then there's a missing day, it doesn't really matter. The missing day will come from the Champions League. One will play on a Tuesday, one play on a Wednesday. There's nothing the league can do about it. So I've never seen, at least I can't remember, a manager coming out and saying, I'm unhappy because we had to play on Sunday rather than Saturday or anything like that, which seems to be much more of a case here. I think Ferguson kind of invented that line of post-management complaint, maybe also for other reasons to deflect from other issues. But it feels to me as if those grudges and complaints are genuine by these players and I don't think managers, and I don't think I've ever seen anything similar in the Bundesliga.
But this doesn't seem anything new to me. As you point out, Raf, Ferguson was doing it a while ago. We've heard sort of feels in the Premier League era like it's an age-old debate and gripe, but ultimately, you know, it's always been part of the Premier League. It will continue to be because, as you mentioned, the spectacle and the television deals, and that's part of it, and the Premier League clubs need the television money, and therefore, if that's a part of the package that the broadcasters want at a time where income from the broadcasters is more important than ever, then we can listen to these gripes and complaints and they can intensify, but I'm not sure it's going to change a great deal.
Now, also on The Athletic at the moment, there are two very detailed reads about what it's like to play for both Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp. You've got some amazing anecdotes, Raf, from players that have played for them.
Not just mine. This was a joint effort. But of course, as you know, I have written about Klopp before on occasion and have spoken to a few players. I guess the thing that comes out is he wants to understand what makes players tick because that helps him then with coaching. And what many would describe as his approachability, his openness, his care for players is ultimately, if you want to be quite hard-nosed about it, just another level of coaching, because he's dealing with people and he wants to understand the best way to help them achieve. And, you know, if that means talking to them about problems they face at home, or phoning up a grandmother whose 80th birthday he is, he'll happily do it, because I guess he's just that kind of guy. So, yeah, I mean, they're kind of recurring patterns. He, I think, plays very strong attention to the psychological element of the game. One line that stood out from this piece is one from Ralf Gunnisch, who played for him just for a year at Mainz as a very young player who'd never played in the Bundesliga before. And there's actually two lines. One that didn't make the cut, but it was quite interesting. I mentioned it here. When he played his first game, the team afterwards was sort of kind of singing and kind of a mix of a celebration and banter, because he'd played his first ever Bundesliga game, and Klopp hadn't been aware of this. And Klopp went up to him and said, "Oh, I didn't know this was your first ever Bundesliga game. If you told me, I would have talked to you a bit more before," which I found was quite caring.
Yeah.
Quite a lovely touch. The other is that he said, and this is something I've heard from many Klopp players, that he would push this one big message: don't let a defeat punish you twice. You know, it's bad enough that you've lost a point, but don't dwell on this. Don't take it with you into the next game, because then you can lose the next game and so on. And it becomes a very negative dynamic. So I think he lives that. You know, we've often, I think, wondered why Klopp has been able to bounce back from some really horrific, traumatic defeats. I mean, he's one of the coaches who've lost one of the most amount of horrific games in terms of how they've been lost and the importance of it at Mainz, at Liverpool in finals. But I think he has this ability to just let things lie and reframe things for positive and go forward. And when players see that from the coach, I think eventually they adopt the same mindset. And then that is, I think, a huge reason why his team are so successful, because in a strange way, they know how to lose. They're actually good losers in that sense.
Yeah, I loved this piece, start to finish. I learned a lot about him, and it's a lot of nuance and really small detail that makes him a really special guy to play for, and the intensity, the even the messaging and the way he addresses his players, very different from the touchline to the dressing room and what we see externally and what's really going on internally, the expectations within training, the adaptability around travel and family. He's the complete package. What I did wonder when I was going through it was, is there anything wrong with Klopp? Like, is there any downside, any negatives, anything that is not so good?
You know, that was one of the problems when I wrote the book, that I couldn't find people to say anything bad about him. There was one guy who I know did not enjoy playing for him at Mainz. And when I spoke to him, he said, "Listen, please understand, I don't want to talk about this on the record. I don't want to be the one guy in Germany who doesn't like Jürgen Klopp." he explained to me eventually that even that disagreement did not come from anything personal, but the fact, and this is quite important for Klopp, but the fact that the player didn't buy into Klopp's ideas. He wanted to play more football. He said, okay, we now have a good team at Mainz. You know, they were fighting against relegation, but maybe they felt a bit more secure after two top 10 finishes. And Klopp said, absolutely not. If we start losing that intensity, if we start thinking we can just play football without the running, we're finished. So he basically axed the guy. And I think that is something that's very typical and very common for Klopp. If you don't believe in the system, if you don't believe in his ideas, he sees you as a very corrosive element and he will be quite ruthless and just get rid of you. And I don't think for him it's personal in the sense that he feels slighted. I think it's more the idea that if you have doubt creeping into a team, if you as a manager let that doubt fester and don't deal with it, and maybe, you know, allow this to be manifested when it comes to defeats, because those people who doubt you then will say, well, we lost because we didn't do things differently, etc., then a dressing room can fall apart. And I think that's something he's been very, very ruthless and hard about, that perhaps people don't have always picked up upon. It's really with him, if you don't buy into this 100%, you cannot be part of a Klopp team.
Good stuff. Raf, do you want to give your own podcast a little plug? We're very generous on this one.
No, we just can't pronounce it.
Thank you very much. Yes, I mean, if you want to know a little bit more about the Bundesliga and all sorts of German football-related issues, please also check out the Stahlcast pod. It's pronounced Stahlcast, but it's actually written Stahlcast. Stilcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. So I did German A-level, David, so I don't see why you're doubting my German pronunciation, but it was a long time ago. Thank you. Cheers, Raf. See you soon.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
See you, mate.
Ciao.
Okay, that's it for this week's pod. Thank you very much, David. Good to have you back.
Well, good to be back. Thank you.
Excellent. And we'll have the Business of Sport podcast, which will drop on Thursday, when Matt Slater will join me for that. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye-bye.